fingers in the clave and the law. Lunacy was what they called it when a shadow hunter heard voices speak to them that no one else could hear, when they saw things that no one else could see. There were other words, uglier ones, but there was no understanding, no sympathy, and no tolerance. Lunacy was a taint, a sign that your brain had rejected the perfection of the angel's blood. Those who were considered lunatics were closed up in the Basileus and never allowed out again. They certainly were not allowed to run institutes. It seemed that the matter of not being loved enough was not the ugliest possibility the Blackthorn children had to face after all. 20. Long ago. The formal dining room at the Institute was rarely used. The family ate in the kitchen except for the rare instances when Uncle Arthur was with them. The room was hung with framed portraits of Blackthorns brought from England, their names etched under their images. Rupert, John, Tristan, Adelaide, Jesse, Tatiana. They gazed down blankly on a long oak table, surrounded by high-backed chairs. Mark settled himself on the table, glancing around the walls.
"I like them," he said, "the portraits. I always have."
"They seem friendly to you?" Emma was leaning against the doorway. The door was cracked partly open, and through it, she could see the foyer and Julian talking to his brothers and sisters. Livy was gripping her saber and looked furious. Ty, beside her, was blank-faced, but his hands were busy at work, tangling and untangling.
"Tavi's awake, playing upstairs," Drusilla was saying.
She was in pajamas, her brown hair mussed.
"Hopefully he'll pass out. Usually he can sleep through a war. I mean..."
"That wasn't a war," Julian said, though there were some bad moments before Malcolm showed up.
"Julian called Malcolm, huh?" Emma said, turning back into the dining room. "Even though you were here, and Malcolm didn't know you're back?"
"He had to," Mark said, and Emma was struck by how human he sounded. He looked human, too, in his jeans and sweater, perched casually on the table. "There were 300 followers surrounding the place, and we couldn't call the conclave."
"He could have asked you to hide," said Emma. There was blood and dirt on her jacket. She flung it over the back of a nearby chair.
"He did," Mark said. "I refused."
"What? Why did you do that?"
Mark said nothing, only looked at her.
"Your hand," he said. "It's bleeding."
Emma glanced down. He was right. There was a cut across her knuckles.
"It's nothing." He reached out to take her hand in his, gazing critically at the blood.
"I could draw you an Arazi," he said. "Just because I don't want them on my skin doesn't mean I won't draw them on anyone else."
Emma retracted her hand. "Don't worry about it," she said, returning to peeking into the entryway.
"What about next time?" Ty was asking. "We're going to have to call the conclave. We can't do this on our own or expect Malcolm always to be there."
"The conclave can't know," Julian said.
"Jules," Livy said, "I mean, we all get it, but isn't there some way? I mean, the conclave would have to understand about Mark. He's our brother."
"I'll handle it," Julian said.
"What if they come back?" Drew said in a small voice.
"Do you trust me?" Julian asked gently. She nodded.
"Then don't worry about it. They won't be back."
Emma sighed to herself as Julian sent his siblings upstairs. He stood watching them go and then turned toward the dining room. Emma drew away from the door and sat down in one of the high-backed chairs just as Julian came into the room. The witch-light chandelier above glared down brightly, an unforgiving, harsh interrogation white. Julian shut the door behind him and leaned against it. His blue-green eyes blazed in his colorless face. When he reached up to push his hair off his forehead, Emma saw that his fingers were bleeding where he had bitten his nails down to the quick. The quick. She learned the term from Diana, watching Julian bite his hands bloody while Ty and Livy practiced in the training room. "Biting his nails down to the quick won't help him learn to hold a sword," Diana had said, and Emma had gone and looked the term up. The quick. The soft, tender flesh underneath the fingernail also means living, as in the quick and the dead. She couldn't help thinking of it as life after that, as if Julian were trying to bite into the bloody matter of his life to cauterize the messiness somehow. She knew he did it when he was upset and anxious, when Ty was unhappy, when Uncle Arthur had a meeting with the Clave, when Helen called and he told her everything was fine, she and Aline shouldn't worry, and yes, he understood why they couldn't come back from Wrangle Island.
and he was doing it now.
"Julian," Emma said, "you don't have to do this if you don't want to. You don't have to tell us anything."
"I do, actually," he said. "I need to talk for a little while without being interrupted. After that, I'll answer any questions you have, all right?"
Mark and Emma nodded.
"After the Dark War, it was only because of Uncle Arthur that they let us come back here, to our home," he said. "It was only because we had a guardian that we were allowed to stay together. A guardian who was related to us, not too young or too old, someone willing to promise to look after 6 children, make sure they were tutored and trained. No one else would have done it except Helen, and she was exiled."
"And I was gone," Mark said bitterly. "It wasn't your fault." Julian stopped, took a deep breath, and shook his head minutely.
"If you talk," he said, "if you say anything, I won't be able to get through this."
Mark ducked his chin.
"My apologies."
"Even if you hadn't been taken, Mark, you'd have been too young. Only someone over 18 can run an institute and be the guardian of children."
Julian glanced down at his hands as if struggling internally, and then looked back up. "The Clave thought Uncle Arthur would be that guardian. So did we.
I thought it when he came here, and even for weeks afterward.
Maybe months. I don't remember. I know that he never really bothered to try to get to know any of us, but I told myself it didn't matter. I told myself we didn't need a guardian who would love us, just someone who would keep us together."
His eyes locked with Emma's, and the next words he spoke seemed to be directly to her. "We loved each other enough, I thought, for it not to matter. Maybe he couldn't show affection, but he could still be a good custodian of the Institute. Then as he came downstairs less and less, and the letters from other institutes and calls from the Clave went unanswered, I started to realize there was more that was seriously wrong. It was soon after the Cold Peace, and territorial disputes were ripping the city apart, vamps and werewolves and warlocks going after what used to belong to fairies. We were besieged with calls, visits, demands we handle the problem. I'd go up to the attic, bring Arthur his food, beg him to deal with what needed to be done to keep the Clave from stepping in. Because I knew what would happen if they did. We'd no longer have a guardian, and then we'd no longer have a home, and then..." He took a deep breath. "They would have sent Emma to the new academy in Idris. It was what they wanted to do in the first place. They would have sent the rest of us to London, probably. Tavi was just a baby. They would have placed him with another family. Drusilla, too. As for Ty, imagine what they would have done with Ty the moment he didn't act the way they thought he should. They would have shoved him into the dregs program at the academy, separated him from Livy. It would have killed them both." Julian paced restlessly up to the portrait of Jesse Blackthorne and stared into his ancestor's green eyes. "So I begged Arthur to respond to the Clave, to do anything that would show that he was the head of the Institute. Letters were piling up, urgent messages. We didn't have weapons, and he wouldn't requisition them. We were running out of Seraph blades. I came upstairs one night to talk to him," his voice cracked, "to ask him if he'd sign letters if I wrote them, about the territorial disputes, and I found him on the floor with a knife. He was cutting his skin open, he said, to let the evil out." He stared steadfastly at the portrait. "I bandaged him up, but after that I talked to him and I realized. Uncle Arthur's reality is not our reality. He lives in a dream world where sometimes I'm Julian and sometimes I'm my father. He talks to people who aren't there. Oh, there are times when he's clear about who he is and where he is, but they come and go. There are bad periods where he doesn't know any of us for weeks, then times of clarity where you might imagine he was getting better, but he'll never get better."
"You're saying he's mad," said Mark.
Madness was the fairy word for it. It was a fairy punishment, in fact, the bringing down of madness, the shattering of someone's mind. Lunacy was what Shadowhunters called it. Emma had a sense there were different words for it among mundanes, a faint sense she had from bits and pieces of movies she had seen, books she had read, that there was a less cruel and absolute way to think about those whose minds ran differently than most, whose thoughts gave them pain and fear. But the Clave was cruel and absolute. It was there in the words that described the code by which they lived. "The law is hard, but it is the law."
"Lunatic, I guess the Clave would say," said Julian with a bitter twist to his mouth. "It's amazing that you're still a shadow hunter if you have a sickness of the body. But apparently not if you have a sickness of the mind. I knew even when I was 12 that if the Clave found out what kind of state Arthur was really in, they'd take the Institute.
They'd break up our family and scatter us, and I would not let that happen. He looked from Mark to Emma, his eyes blazing. I had enough of my family taken from me during the war, he said. We all did. We'd lost so much. Mother, father, Helen, Mark. They would have torn us apart until we were adults, and by then we wouldn't be a family anymore. They were my children. Livy, Ty, Drew, Tavi. I raised them. I became Uncle Arthur. I took the correspondence. I answered it. I did the requisitioning. I drew up the patrol schedules. I never let anyone know Arthur was sick. I said he was eccentric, a genius, hard at work in his attic. The truth was... He looked away. When I was younger, I hated him. I never wanted him to come out of his attic, but sometimes he had to. The disputes over territory had to be handled in person. There were face-to-face meetings that couldn't be avoided, and no one was going to hold their important summit with a 12-year-old boy. So I went to Malcolm. He was able to create a drug that I could give to Uncle Arthur. It forced periods of clarity. They only lasted a few hours, and afterward Arthur would have headaches. Emma thought of the way Arthur had clutched his head after the meeting with the fairy representatives in the sanctuary. The memory of the agony on his face, she couldn't push it away, though she wanted to. Sometimes I try to keep him out of the way with other methods, Julian said, his voice full of self-loathing. Like tonight. Malcolm gave him a sleeping draft. I know it's wrong, believe me, I felt like I might go to hell for it, if there is a hell. I knew I shouldn't do what I was doing. Malcolm kept quiet, he never told anyone, but I could tell he didn't exactly approve. He wanted me to tell the truth, but the truth would have destroyed our family. Mark leaned forward, his expression was unreadable. What about Diana? I never exactly told her, said Julian, but I think she's guessed at least some of it. Why couldn't she have been asked to run the institute, instead of it being in the hands of a 12-year-old boy? I asked her. She said no. She said it was impossible. She was genuinely sorry, and she said she'd help however she could. Diana has her own secrets. He turned away from the portrait of Jesse. One last thing. I said I hated Arthur, but that was a long time ago. I don't hate him now. I hate the Clave for what they would do to him, to us. If they knew. He bent his head, the extraordinarily bright witch light turned the edges of his hair to gold and the scars on his skin to silver. So now you know, he said. His hands tightened on the back of the chair. If you hate me, I understand. I can't think of anything else I could have done, but I'd understand. Emma stood up from her chair. I think we knew, she said. We didn't know, but we knew. She looked at Julian. We did, didn't we? We knew someone was taking care of everything and that it wasn't Arthur. If we let ourselves believe he ran the Institute, it was because it was easier. It was what we wanted to be true. Julian closed his eyes. When he opened them again, they were fixed on his brother. Mark, he said, and the question was implicit in the single word. Mark, do you hate me? Mark slid off the table. The witch light turned his pale hair to white. I have no right to pass judgment upon you, brother. Once I was the elder, but now you are elder than I. When I was in the fairy country, each night I would think of each of you and Helen, of Livy and Ty, and Drew and Tavi. I gave the stars your names, so that when I saw them wink to light in the sky, I felt as if you were with me. It was all I could do to still the fear that you were hurt or dying, and that I would never know. But I have come back to a family not just alive and healthy, but whose bonds have not been severed, and that is because of what you have done. There is love here among you, such love as takes my breath out of my body. There has even been enough love left for me. Julian was looking at Mark with hesitant astonishment. Emma tasted tears in the back of her throat. She wanted to go to Julian and put her arms around him, but a thousand things held her back. If you want me to tell the others, Julian said hoarsely, I will. Now is not the time to decide, Mark said, and in that single sentence, in the way he looked at Julian now, for the first time since Mark had returned, Emma could see a world in which Mark and Julian had been together, had raised their siblings together, and come to agreements about what to do together. For the first time, she could see the harmony they had lost. Not when there are enemies circling us in the Institute, not when our lives and blood are on the line.
It's a heavy burden to bear this secret, said Julian, and there was a warning in his tone, but hopefulness as well. Emma's heart ached for the wrongness of all of it, for the painful and desperate choices made by a 12-year-old boy to keep his family with him, for the darkness that surrounded Arthur Blackthorne, which was not of his making, but which, if revealed, would only find him punished by his own government, for the weight of a 1,000 lies told in good faith, because lies told in good faith were still lies. And if the followers go through with their threat... But how did they know? Emma said. How did they know about Arthur? Julian shook his head. I don't know, he said. But I think we're going to need to find out. Christina watched as Diego, having laid her down on one of the infirmary beds, realized that he couldn't sit beside her with a sword and crossbow attached to him, and began awkwardly to remove them. Diego was rarely awkward. In her memory, he was graceful, the more graceful of the two Rocio Rosales brothers, though Jaime was more warlike and more fierce. He hung his crossbow and sword up, then unzipped his dark hoodie and flung it over one of the pegs near the door. He was facing away from her. Through his white T-shirt, she could see that he had dozens of new scars, and even more marks, some of them permanent. A great black rune for courage in battle spread down his right shoulder blade, a tendril of it rising above his collar. He looked as if he'd grown broader, his waist, shoulders, and back hard with a new layer of muscle. His hair had grown out, long enough to touch his collar. It brushed against his cheek as he turned to look at her. She had been able to fight off her shock at seeing Diego in the whirl of events since she'd seen his face in the alley. But now it was only the two of them, alone in the infirmary, and she was looking at him and seeing the past. The past she'd run away from and tried to forget. It was there, in the way he pulled out the chair beside her bed and leaned over to carefully unlace her boots, pull them away, and roll up the left leg of her pants. It was there in the way his lashes brushed his cheeks when he concentrated, running the point of his steely over her leg beside the wound, circling it in healing runes. It was there in the freckle at the corner of his mouth, and the way he frowned as he sat back and surveyed his rune work critically. Christina, he said, is it better? The pain had eased. She nodded, and he sat back, his steely in his hand. He was gripping it tightly enough that the old scar across the back of his hand stood out whitely, and she remembered the same scar in his fingers unbuttoning his shirt in her bedroom in San Miguel de Allende, while the bells of the parroquia rang out through the windows. It's better, she said. Good, he put the steely away. Tenemos que hablar. In English, please, she said. I'm trying to keep up my practice. An irritated look passed across his face. You don't need the practice. Your English is perfect, as mine is. Modest as always. His smile flashed out. I've missed you giving me a hard time. Diego. She shook her head. You shouldn't be here, and you shouldn't say you miss me. His face was all sharp lines, pronounced cheekbones and jaw and temples. Only his mouth was soft, the corners turned down now in unhappiness. She remembered the first time she had ever kissed him, in the Institute garden, then pushed the recollection away viciously. But it is the truth, he said. Christina, why did you run away like that? Why didn't you answer any of my messages or calls? She held up a hand. You first, she said. What are you doing in Los Angeles? He rested his chin on his folded arms. After you left, I couldn't stay. Everything reminded me of you. I was on leave from the Scholomance. We were going to spend the summer together. Then you were gone. One minute you were in my life, and then you were ripped out of it. I was lost. I went back to study, but I thought only of you. You had Jaime, she said in a hard voice. No one has Jaime, he said. You think you didn't panic when you left? The two of you were supposed to be parabatai. I think he'll live. Christina could hear her own voice, cold and small. It seemed to have frozen down to a tiny sliver of ice. He was silent for a moment. Reports were coming through the Scholomance from L.A., he said. Flares of necromantic magic. Your friend Emma's efforts to investigate the deaths of her parents. The Clave thought she was making a fuss about nothing. That it was clear Sebastian had killed her parents, but she wouldn't accept it. I thought she might be right, though. I came out here to look into it, and my first day, I went to the shadow market. Look, it's a long story. I found my way to Wells's house.
where you decided it was a good idea to shoot a fellow Nephilim with a crossbow? I didn't know they were shadow hunters. I thought they were murderers. I wasn't shooting to kill.
No manches, Christina said bluntly. You should have stayed and told them you were Nephilim. Those arrows were poisoned. Julian nearly died.
I gathered that.
Diego looked rueful.
The arrows weren't poisoned by me. If I'd had any idea, I would have stayed. The weapons I bought at the Shadow Market must have been tainted without my knowing.
Well, what were you doing by weapons there anyway? Why didn't you come to the Institute? Christina demanded.
I did, Diego said, flattening her with surprise. I came looking for Arthur Blackthorn. I found him in the sanctuary. I tried to tell him who I was, why I was here. He told me the damnation of the Blackthorns was their own private business, and that they didn't want any interference, and that if I knew what was good for me, I'd get out of town before everything burned.
He said that? Christina sat up in astonishment.
I realized I wasn't welcome here.
I thought even that the Blackthorns might be involved in the necromancy somehow.
They would never. Well, you can say that. You know them.
I didn't know them.
All I knew was that the head of the Institute had told me to go away, but I couldn't because you were here. Maybe in danger, maybe even in danger from the Blackthorns. I had to get the weapons at the market because I was afraid that if I went to any of the usual weapons caches, it would be found out that I was still here.
Look, Christina, I'm not a liar.
You don't lie? Christina demanded. You want to know why I left home, Diego? In May, we were in San Miguel de Allende. I'd gone to the jardín, and when I came back, you and Jaime were sitting up on the terrace. I was coming through the courtyard. I could hear your voices very clearly. You didn't know I was there.
Diego looked puzzled.
I heard him talking to you about how the wrong branch of the Rosales family was in power. It should have been you. He was talking about the plan he had.
Surely you remember.
The one where you would marry me, and he would become my parabatai, and together, you would use your influence over me and my mother to eject her from her position as head of the DF Institute, and then you would take over.
He said you had the easy job, marrying me, because you could leave me someday. Becoming parabatai means you're stuck with them forever. I remember him saying that.
Christina.
Diego had gone pale.
That's why you left that night? It wasn't because your mother was sick and needed you at the Institute in the city.
I was the one who was sick, Christina spat. You broke my heart, Diego. You and your brother.
I don't know what's worse, losing your best friend or losing the boy you're in love with, but I can tell you that it was like you both died for me that day. That's why I don't pick up your calls or messages. You don't take calls from a dead boy.
And what about Jaime?
Something flared in his eyes. What about his calls?
He never has called, said Christina, and almost took pleasure in the look of shock on his face.
Maybe he has better sense than you.
Jaime.
Jaime. Diego was on his feet now. A vein in his temple throbbed. I remember that day, Christina. Jaime was drunk and he was babbling. Did you hear me say anything, or did you only hear him?
Christina forced herself to think back. In memory, it seemed like a cacophony of voices, but...
I only heard Jaime, she said. I didn't hear you say a word, not to defend me, not to say anything.
There was no point talking to Jaime when he was like that, Diego said bitterly.
I let him talk. I shouldn't have. I had no interest in his plan. I loved you. I wanted to go far away with you. He is my brother, but he was born with something missing, I think, some piece of his heart where compassion lives.
He was going to be my parabatai, said Christina. I was going to be tied to him forever. And you weren't going to say anything to me? Do anything to stop it?
I was, Diego protested. Jaime had planned to go to Idris. I was waiting for him to leave. I needed to speak to you when he wasn't there.
She shook her head.
You shouldn't have waited.
Christina,
he came toward her, his hands outstretched. Please, if you don't believe anything else, believe me that I have always loved you.
Do you really think I have lied to you since we were children?
Since the first time I ever kissed you and you ran away laughing?
I was 10 years old. Do you really think that was some kind of plan?
She didn't reach for his hands.
But Jaime, she said, I've known him just as long. He was always my friend.
But he wasn't, was he?
He said things no friend would say, and you knew he was using me, and you said not a word.
I was going to tell you.
Intentions are nothing, Christina said.
She had thought she would feel some relief.
finally telling Diego why she hated him, finally unburdening the knowledge of what she had heard, finally severing the thread. But it didn't feel severed. She could feel the bond connecting them, as she had when she had blacked out in the crashing car outside the Institute and woken up with Diego holding her. He'd been whispering in her ear that she would be all right, that she was his Christina, she was strong. And it had felt for a moment as if the past months had been a dream, and she was home.
"I must stay here," Diego said. "These killings, the followers, they are too important. I am a centurion, I cannot abandon a mission. But I do not need to remain at the Institute. If you want me to go away, I will."
Christina opened her mouth. But before she could speak, her phone buzzed. It was a message from Emma. "Stop making out with Perfect Diego and get to the computer room. We need you." Christina rolled her eyes and shoved the phone back in her pocket. "We better go."
21. A wind blew.
The sky outside the Institute had turned the color of what was very late night or very early morning, depending on your point of view. It had always reminded Julian of blue cellophane or watercolor, the intense blue of evening turned translucent by the imminent arrival of the sun. The inhabitants of the Institute, all but Arthur, who slept on soundly in his attic, had gathered in the computer room. Ty had brought papers and books from the library, and the others were going through them. Tavi was curled up asleep in the corner. Piles of empty pizza boxes from nightshades were stacked on the table. Emma didn't even remember them being delivered, but most of them had been eaten. Mark was busy glaring at Christina and Diego, though Diego didn't seem to notice. He didn't seem to notice Drusilla staring at him with saucer eyes either. He didn't notice much, Julian thought uncharitably. Maybe being ridiculously good-looking was more time-consuming than it seemed. Emma had finished telling the story of the way she and Christina had tracked down Sterling and the things he had told them on the car ride home. Ty had been taking notes with a pencil, a second pencil stuck behind his ear. His black hair was ruffled up like a cat's fur. Julian remembered when Ty had been young enough that he could reach out and smooth down his younger brother's hair when it got too messy. Something in him ached at the recollection.
"So," Ty said now, turning to Diego and Christina, who was sitting beside Diego.
She was barefoot, one of her pant legs rolled up and her calf bound with bandages. Every once in a while she would shoot Diego a look out of the corner of her eye that was half suspicion, half relief. That he'd helped her, that he was there at all, Julian wasn't sure.
"You're a centurion." "I studied at the Scholomance," said Diego. "I was the youngest aspirant ever to become a centurion." Everyone looked impressed except Mark, even Ty.
"That's like being a detective, isn't it?" he said. "You investigate for the Clave?"
"That is one of the things we do," said Diego. "We stand outside the law that precludes shadow hunters from involving themselves in issues that relate to fairies."
"The Clave can make that exception for any shadow hunter, though, in exigent cases," said Julian.
"Why was Diana told we couldn't investigate? Why did they send you?"
"It was judged that your family, with your connection to the fair folk, would not be able to objectively investigate a series of murders where some of the victims were fairies."
"That is entirely unreasonable," Mark said, his eyes flashing.
"Is it?" Diego glanced around. "From all I have heard and seen, you appear to have mounted a secret investigation into this issue, telling the Clave nothing about it. You've compiled evidence that you have not shared. You've discovered a murderous cult operating in secret."
"You make it sound so shady," Emma said. "So far, all you've done is show up in L.A. and shoot another shadow hunter."
Diego glanced over at Julian.
"It's mostly healed," Julian said.
"Mostly."
"I bet you didn't report that to the Scholomance," said Emma. "Did you, Perfect Diego?"
"I have reported nothing to the Scholomance," Diego said. "Not since I found out Christina was involved in this as well. I would never hurt her."
Christina blushed furiously.
"You're a centurion," Ty said. "You have vows."
"Vows of friendship and love are stronger," said Diego.
Drusilla looked at him with cartoon hearts in her eyes.
"That's beautiful."
Mark rolled his eyes. He was clearly not a member of the Perfect Diego Appreciation Society.
"That's very touching," said Emma. "Now talk. What do you know?"
Julian glanced at her. She seemed like Emma, ordinary Emma, sharp and encouraging and tough and normal. She even smiled at him quickly before turning her attention back to Diego. Julian listened, half his brain recording Diego's story. The other half was in chaos. For the past 5 years, he had walked a narrow rockway above the ocean,
falling away sheer on either side to a boiling cauldron. He'd kept his balance by keeping his secrets. Mark had forgiven him, but it wasn't just Mark he'd lied to. Lying to your parabatai, it wasn't forbidden, but most parabatai didn't. They didn't need or want to conceal things. That he'd concealed so much from Emma must have shocked her. He gazed at her face covertly, trying to read the signs of shock or anger, but he could tell nothing. Her face was maddeningly unreadable as Diego launched into his story. When Diego explained that he had come to the Institute when he arrived in Los Angeles, and that Uncle Arthur had chased him off, telling him he didn't want non-Blackthorns interfering in Blackthorn problems, Livy raised a questioning hand. "Why would he do that?" she said. "Uncle Arthur doesn't like strangers, but he's not a liar." Emma glanced away from her. Julian felt his stomach tighten, his secrets still a burden. "A lot of shadow hunters of the older generation don't trust centurions," he added. "The Skolomance was closed in 1872, and centurions no longer trained. You know how adults are about things they didn't grow up with." Livy shrugged, looking mildly placated. Ty was scribbling in his notebook. "Where did you go after that, Diego?" "He met Johnny Rook," said Christina, "and Rook tipped him off about the sepulchre, just like he did with Emma." "I went there immediately," Diego said. "I'd been waiting days in the alleys behind the bar." His eyes flicked to Christina. Julian wondered with a sort of distant cynicism if it was as obvious to everyone else as it was to him that Diego had done everything he did because of Christina. That if he hadn't been in a panic over her welfare, it was unlikely he would have rushed to the sepulchre and spent days watching the place to see what would happen.
"Then I heard a girl screaming."
Emma sat up straight. "We didn't hear that."
"I think it was before you arrived," said Diego. "I followed the sound and saw a group of followers, including Belinda, though I didn't know who they were then, attacking a girl, slapping her, spitting on her. There were chalk protective circles drawn on the ground. I saw that symbol, the lines of water under the sign for fire. I had seen it at the market, an old, old sign for resurgence."
"Resurgence," echoed Ty. "Necromancy?"
Diego nodded. "I fought off the followers, but the girl got away, ran to her car."
"That was Ava?" Emma guessed.
"Yes. She saw me and raced off. I followed her to her house, managed to convince her to tell me everything she knew about the Midnight Theater, the followers, the lottery. It wasn't much, but I learned that she had been chosen by the lottery, that she had been the one who killed Stanley Wells, knowing that if she didn't, she would be tortured and killed herself."
"She told you everything?" Livy said in amazement. "But they're sworn to secrecy."
He shrugged.
"I don't know why she took me into her confidence."
"Seriously, dude," Emma said.
"Do not own any mirrors."
"Emma," hissed Christina. "She'd murdered him a few days before. She was already torn apart by guilt. She'd shown up in the alley because she wanted to see his body. She said an odd thing about the chalk circles, that they were useless, there to mislead." "Very little she was saying made sense," he frowned. "I told her I would protect her. I slept on her porch. The next day she demanded I leave. She said she wished to be with the Guardian and the other followers, that it was her place. She insisted I go, so I went. I returned to the market, bought weaponry from Johnny Rook. When I came back to Ava's that night, she was dead. She had been choked and drowned in the pool, her hand sliced off."
"I don't understand what's going on with the hands," said Emma. "Ava was missing one hand and was killed. Belinda was missing a hand, but they let her live. And she cut off both Sterling's hands after he died." "Maybe they're proof to the Guardian that someone's dead," said Livy. "Like the huntsman bringing back Snow White's heart in a box."
"Or maybe they're part of the spell," said Diego with a frown. "Ava and Belinda were missing their dominant hands. Perhaps Belinda didn't know which was Sterling's, so she took both."
"A piece of the killer to go with the sacrifice," Julian said. "We're going to need to dig more deeply into the necromancy section of the library."
"Yes," said Diego. "I wish I had access to your library after I found Ava Lee dead. I had failed in my duty to protect a mundane who needed my help. I swore I would find out who had done it. I waited on her roof."
"Yeah, we know what happened," Julian said. "I'll remember it every time I have a twinge in my side during cold weather." Diego inclined his head. "I'm very sorry about that."
"I want to know what happened next," Ty said, still scribbling away in his elegant, incomprehensible handwriting. Julian had always thought it looked like cat footprints dancing across a page. His slim, long fingers already had pencil lead on them. "You found out Sterling was the next one chosen and followed him?"
Yes, Diego said. And I saw you were trying to protect him. I didn't understand why. I'm sorry, but after what Arthur said to me, I suspected you all. I knew I should turn you into the Clave, but I couldn't do it.
He looked at Christina, and then away.
I was outside the bar tonight hoping to stop Sterling, but I admit I also wanted your side of the story. Now I have it. I'm glad I was wrong about your involvement.
You should be, muttered Mark.
Diego sat back. So maybe now you can tell me what you know. It would only be fair.
Julian was relieved when Mark took point on the summary. He was scrupulous about the details, even the bargain with the fairies over his own fate and the results of his presence at the Institute.
Blackthorn blood, Diego said thoughtfully when Mark was done.
That is interesting. I would have guessed the Carstairs had more relevance to these spells, given the deaths 5 years ago.
Emma's parents, you mean, said Julian.
He remembered them, their laughing eyes and their love for Emma. They could never be just the deaths to him.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Tavi slide off the armchair where he'd been curled up. Quietly, he went to the door and slipped out. He must be exhausted. He'd probably been waiting for Julian to put him to bed. Julian felt a pang for his smallest brother, so often trapped in rooms full of older people talking about blood and death.
Yes, said Diego. One of the questions I have had has been the fact that they were killed 5 years ago, and then there were no more killings until this last year. Why such a gap in time?
We thought maybe the spell required it,
Livy said and yawned. She looked exhausted, dark shadows under her eyes.
They all did.
That is another thing. In the car, Sterling said it didn't matter what kind of creature they killed, human or fairy, even Nephilim, if we count the Carstairs murders.
Christina said.
He said they couldn't murder werewolves or warlocks.
I imagine they were staying away from creatures protected by the Accords, said Julian. It would have drawn attention, our attention.
Yes, said Diego.
But otherwise, for not to matter what kind of victim they choose, human or fairy, male or female, old or young, sacrificial magic requires commonalities among the victims, all those with the sight, all virgins, or all with a certain type of blood. Here it seems random.
Ty was looking at Diego with open admiration.
The Skulloman sounds so cool, he said. I had no idea they let you learn so much about spells and magic.
Diego smiled.
Drusilla looked as if she might fall over.
Livy looked as if she'd be impressed if she wasn't so tired. And Mark looked even more annoyed.
Can I see the photos of the conversions? Said Diego.
It sounds very significant. I'm impressed you found it.
It was surrounded by manta demons when we went, so we've pictures of the inside, but not the outside.
Mark said as Ty went to get the photos.
As for the demons, Emma and I took care of them.
He winked at Emma.
She smiled, and Julian felt that short, sharp jab of jealousy that came whenever Mark flirted with Emma. He knew it didn't mean anything. Mark flirted in that way that fairies did, with a sort of courtly humor that had no real weight behind it. But Mark could flirt with Emma if he wanted. He had a choice, and fairies were notoriously fickle. And if Mark was interested, then he, Julian, had no right or reason to object.
He should support his brother. Wouldn't he be lucky, after all, if his brother and Parabatai fell in love? Didn't people dream about the people who they loved loving one another?
Diego raised an eyebrow at Mark, but said nothing as Tiberius spread the pictures out on the coffee table.
It's energy magic, said Ty. We know that much.
Yes, said Diego. Energy can be stored, especially death energy, and used later in necromancy. But we don't know what someone would need all that energy for.
For a summoning spell, said Livy and yawned again. That's what Malcolm said anyway.
A small crease appeared between Diego's brows.
It is unlikely to be a summoning spell, he said. Death energy allows you to do death magic. This magician is trying to bring back someone from the dead.
But who? Said Ty after a pause.
Someone powerful?
No, said Drusilla. He's trying to bring back Annabelle. Annabelle Lee.
Everyone looked surprised that Drew had spoken. So surprised that she seemed to shrink back into herself a little. Diego, though, gave her an encouraging smile.
The poem's written on the inside of the Convergence Cave, right?
She went on looking around worriedly. And everyone was trying to figure out if it was a code or a spell. But what if it's just a reminder? This person, the magician, they lost someone they loved, and they're trying to bring her back.
Someone so mad to get back their lost love that they founded a cult, killed more than a dozen people, created that cave at the Convergence, etched that poem on the wall, created a portal to the ocean? Livy sounded dubious.
I would do it, Drew said, if it was someone I really loved. It might not even have been a girlfriend, maybe a mother or a sister or whatever. I mean, you do it for Emma, right, Jules, if she died?
The black horror that was the thought of Emma dying rose against the backs of Julian's eyes. He said,
"Don't be morbid, Drew," in a voice that sounded very distant to his own ears.
"Julian," Emma said, "are you all right?" Thankfully, he didn't need to answer. A solemn voice spoke from the doorway.
"Drew is right," Tavi said.
He hadn't gone to sleep after all. He stood by the door, wide-eyed, brown hair tousled. He had always been small for his age, and his eyes were big blue-green saucers in his pale face. He was holding something behind his back.
"Tavi," Julian said.
"Tavs, what have you got there?"
Tavi drew his hand from behind his back. He was carrying a book, a child's book, oversized with an illustrated cover. The title was printed in gold foil. A Treasury of Tales for Nephilim.
A Shadowhunter children's book. There were such things, though, not many of them. The printing presses in Idris were small.
"Where did you get that?" Emma asked, honestly curious. She'd had something like it as a child, but it had been lost with many of her parents' things in the chaos after the war.
"Great-Aunt Marjorie gave it to me," Tavi said. "I like most of the stories. The one about the first Parabatai is good, but some of them are sad and scary, like the one about Tobias Herondale, and the one about Lady Midnight is the saddest."
"Lady what?" said Christina, leaning forward.
"Midnight," said Tavi. "Like the theater you went to. I heard Mark say the rhyme, and I just remembered I read it before."
"You read it before?" Mark echoed incredulously.
"When did you see that fairy rhyme, Octavian?"
Tavi opened the book.
"There was a Shadowhunter lady," he said. "She fell in love with someone she wasn't supposed to be in love with. Her parents trapped her in an iron castle, and you couldn't get in. She died of sadness, so the man who loved her went to the king of the fairies and asked if there was a way to bring her back. He said there was a rhyme. First the flame and then the flood. In the end, it's blackthorn blood. Seek thou to forget what's past. Verse 13 and then the last. Search not the book of angels gray. Red or white will lead you far astray. To regain what you have lost, find the black book at any cost."
"So what happened," said Emma, "to the man who went to fairy?"
"He ate and drank fairy food," said Tavi. "He was trapped there. The legend is that the sound of the waves crashing on the beach is his cries for her to return."
Julian exhaled.
"How did we not find this?"
"Because it's a children's book," said Emma. "It wouldn't have been in the library."
"That's dumb," said Tavi serenely. "It's a good book."
"But why?" Julian said. "Why blackthorn blood?"
"Because she was a blackthorn," said Tavi. "Lady Midnight. They called her that because she had long black hair, but she had the same eyes as the rest of us. Look."
He turned the book around to show a haunting illustration. A woman whose jet black hair spilled over her shoulders reached out for the retreating figure of a man, her eyes wide and blue-green as the sea.
Livy gave a little gasp, reaching for the book. Hesitantly, Tavi let her have it.
"Don't tear the pages," he warned.
"So this is the full rhyme," she said. "This is what's written on the bodies."
"It's instructions," Mark said. "If the rhyme is a true fairy rhyme, then for the right person, it is a clear list of instructions. How to bring back the dead. Not just any dead, but her, this blackthorn woman."
13, said Emma. Despite her exhaustion, her heart was racing with excitement. She met Christina's eyes across the room.
"Yes," Christina breathed.
"What Sterling said after we caught him. After he'd killed the girl. He said she was the 13th.
Emma said, "First 13 and then the last. He's killed 13. He's got one last one to go and then he's done. He'll have enough magic to bring back Lady Midnight."
"So there'll be one more," Julian said. "One that might be different from the last."
"There must be more instructions than this," said Ty.
No one could figure out exactly how to complete this spell just from this rhyme. He looked around, a flicker of uncertainty in his gray eyes. The look he got very rarely, but sometimes, when he thought that there was something in the world that everyone understood but him. Could they?
No, Mark said. But the rhyme tells you where to look for the rest of the instructions.
Search not the book of Angels Gray. The answer is not in the gray book. Nor is it in the book of the white or in the red texts.
It is in the black volume of the dead, said Diego. I've heard of that book in the Scholomance.
What is it? Said Emma. Are there copies? Is it something we could get a hold of?
Diego shook his head. It is a book of very dark magic, almost legendary. Even warlocks are forbidden to own it. If there are copies, I do not know where. But we should set ourselves to find out, tomorrow.
Yeah, Livy said, her voice blurry with sleep. Tomorrow.
Do you need to go to bed, Livy? Julian asked. It was a rhetorical question. Livy was drooping like a wilted dandelion. At his words, though, she forced herself bolt upright.
No, I'm fine. I could stay up.
Ty's face changed subtly as he looked at his twin sister.
I'm exhausted, he said. I think we should all go to sleep. In the morning, we'll be able to concentrate better.
Julian doubted Ty was actually tired at all. When he was engaged in a puzzle, he could stay up for days at a time. But Livy nodded gratefully at the words.
You're right, she said. She slid off the chair she was sitting on and picked up Tavi, handing him back his book.
Come on, she said.
You should definitely be in bed.
I helped, though, didn't I? Tavi asked as his sister carried him toward the door. He was looking over at Julian as he said it, and Julian remembered himself as a child, looking toward Andrew Blackthorne that way, a boy looking to his father, seeking approval.
You didn't just help, said Julian. I think you may have solved it, Tavs.
Yay, said Tavi sleepily, and put his head down on Livy's shoulder.
The others soon followed Ty and Livy to bed, but Emma found she couldn't sleep. She found herself, instead, sitting on the front steps of the Institute before the sun rose. She was in flip-flops, a tank top, and pajama bottoms. The air coming off the ocean was chilly, but she didn't feel it. She was staring at the water. From every angle of the steps, you could see the ocean, blue-black in the rising morning now, like ink, raked with swells of white foam where the waves broke far out to sea. The moon had shrunk and cast an angular shadow across the water, a blue and silver dawn. She remembered the spilling cold of that blue ocean all around her, the taste of salt water and demon blood, the feeling that the water was pressing her down, crushing her bones. And the worst part, the fear that once her parents had felt the same pain, the same panic. She thought of Julian then, the way he looked in the dining room, the strain in his voice as he'd stood there telling her and Mark everything he'd done for the past 5 years.
Emma. Emma half-turned and saw Perfect Diego coming down the steps. He looked immaculate, despite the night they'd had. Even his boots were polished. His dark brown hair was thick and fell chimingly over one of his eyes. He looked a bit like a prince in a fairy tale book. She thought of Julian again, his untidy hair, his bitten nails, his dusty boots, the paint on his hands.
Hey, Perfect Diego, she said. I wish you wouldn't call me that.
You wish in vain, Emma said. Where are you going? Is Christine all right?
She's asleep, Perfect Diego looked out at the ocean. It's very beautiful here. You must find it peaceful.
And you must be kidding.
He flashed a fairly perfect smile.
You know, when there aren't murders happening and small armies surrounding the place.
Where are you going? Emma asked again. It's practically dawn.
I know the cave will not be open, but I'm going to the convergence site to see it for myself. The demons should have disbanded by now. I want to take another look around the area, see if there's anything you missed.
You are just bursting with tact, aren't you? Emma said.
Fine, go ahead. See what we all missed while we were nearly being cut to pieces by giant grasshopper demons.
Mantids aren't technically grasshoppers.
Emma glared. Diego shrugged and jogged to the foot of the steps. He paused there and looked back over his shoulder at her.
Does anyone else in the clave know about your investigation? He said.
Anyone but your family.
Just Diana, said Emma.
Diana is your tutor?
When Emma nodded, he frowned.
Weren't Jace Herondale and the Lightwoods betrayed by their own tutor?
She'd never betray us, Emma said, outraged. Not to the clave or to anyone else. Hodge Starkweather was different.
Different how?
Starkweather wasn't Diana. He was a minion of Valentine's. Diana's a good person.
So where is she now? Diego asked.
I'd like to meet her. Emma hesitated.
She's in Thailand, said a voice from behind them. It was Julian. He'd shrugged on a hooded army jacket over his jeans and t-shirt. There was a witch there she wanted to question about energy spells. Someone she knew when she was younger, he paused. We can trust her. Diego inclined his head. I didn't mean to imply otherwise.
Julian leaned against one of the pillars, and he and Emma watched as Diego strode away across the trampled grass and headed down the road. The moon had disappeared entirely, and the eastern sky was beginning to turn pink.
What are you doing out here? Julian said finally in a quiet voice.
I couldn't sleep, said Emma.
Julian had his head tipped back, as if he were bathing in the dim illumination of the dawn. The strange light made him into something else. Someone made out of marble and silver. Someone whose inky curls clung to his temples and neck like the acanthus leaves in Greek art. He wasn't perfect, like Diego, but to Emma, there had never been anyone more beautiful.
We're going to have to talk about this eventually, she said. What you told me and Mark.
I know. He looked down at his long legs, the frayed hems of his jeans, his boots. I suppose I'd hoped it would never happen, or that at least we'd be adults when it did.
So let's be adults about it.
Why didn't you tell me before?
Do you think I liked keeping secrets from you? Do you think I didn't want to tell you?
If you'd wanted to, you could have.
No, I couldn't. He spoke with a quiet despair.
Did you not trust me? Did you think I'd tell on you?
Julian shook his head.
That wasn't it.
Enough light had spread over the landscape for the color of his eyes to be visible despite the darkness. They looked like artificially illuminated water. Emma thought of the night Julian's mother had died. She had been ill, attended by silent brothers to the end. There were some diseases even Nephilim magic couldn't cure. She had cancer of the bone, and it had killed her. Andrew Blackthorne, newly widowed, had been too devastated to be the one to go to Tavi when the baby cried in the night. Helen had been efficient, heating Tavi's bottles, changing him, dressing him. But Julian had been the one who stayed with him during the day. While Mark and Helen trained, Julian sat in Tavi's room and sketched or painted. Emma would sit with him there sometimes, and they would play the way they normally did, with the baby gurgling in his crib a few feet away. At the time, Emma hadn't thought much of it. She, like Julian, had been only 10 years old, but she recalled it now.
I remember when your mother died, she said, and you took care of Tavi during the days. I asked you why, and I remember what you said. Do you?
I said it was because no one else could, said Julian, looking at her quizzically. Mark and Helen had to train. My father was, well, you know how he was.
Everything you've done is because no one else would or could do it. If you hadn't covered up for Arthur, no one else would have even thought of it. If you hadn't been so determined to hold everything together, no one else would have. Maybe it started back then when you took care of Tavi. Maybe it gave you the idea. He exhaled.
Maybe. I don't entirely know myself.
I still wish you told me. I know you thought you were being unselfish.
I didn't, he said. She looked at him in surprise.
I did it for entirely selfish reasons, he said. You were my escape, Emma. You were my way away from everything terrible. When I was with you, I was happy.
Emma stood up.
But that can't have been the only time you were happy.
Of course I'm happy with my family, he said. But I'm responsible for them. I was never responsible for you. We're responsible for each other. That's what parabatai means, don't you understand? Emma, you're the only one who was ever meant to look after me.
Then I failed you, she said, feeling a bone-deep sense of disappointment with herself.
I should have known what you were going through, and I didn't.
Don't ever say that again. He shoved himself away from the pillar, the rising sun behind him turning the edges of his hair to copper. Emma couldn't see his expression, but she knew it was furious. Emma got to her feet.
What? That I should have known? I should have.
That you failed me, he said hotly. If you knew, you've been all that's kept me going for weeks, sometimes months. Even when I was in England, thinking of you kept me going. It's why I had to be parabatai with you.
It was completely selfish. I wanted to tie you to me no matter what, even though I knew it was a bad idea, even though I knew I...
He broke off, a look of horror flashing across his face.
Even though what? Emma demanded. Her heart was pounding. Even though what, Julian?
He shook his head. Her hair had escaped from its ponytail, and the wind was whipping it around her face, bright pale strands on the wind. He reached up to tuck one behind her ear. He looked like someone caught in a dream trying to wake up.
It doesn't matter, he said.
Do you love me? Her voice was a whisper.
He wound a piece of her hair around his finger, a silver-gold ring.
What's the difference? He asked.
It won't change anything if I do.
It changes things, she whispered. It changes everything for me.
Emma, he said. You better go back inside. Go to sleep. We both should. She gritted her teeth. If you're going to walk away from me now, you'll have to do it yourself.
He hesitated. She saw the tension in him, in his body, rise like a wave about to break.
Walk away from me, she said harshly. Walk away.
His tension crested and fell. Something in him seemed to collapse, water breaking against rocks.
I can't, he said, his voice low and broken.
God, I can't. And he half-closed his eyes, bringing up his other hand to cradle her face. His hand slid into her hair, and he drew her toward him. She inhaled a breath of cold air, and then his mouth was on hers, and her senses exploded. She had wondered, in the back of her mind, if what had happened on the beach between them had been a fluke born of their shared adrenaline. Surely kisses weren't meant to be like that, so all-encompassing that they ripped through you like lightning, tore down your defenses and decimated your self-control. Apparently not. Her hands fisted in the material of Julian's jacket, dragging him toward her closer, closer. There was sugar and caffeine on his lips. He tasted like energy. Her hands slid up under his shirt, touching the bare skin of his back, and he broke away from her to suck in his breath. His eyes were closed, his lips parted.
Emma, he breathed, and the desire in his voice tore a scorching path through her.
When he reached for her, she almost fell against him. He swiveled her body around, pushing her back against a pillar, his body a strong, hot line against hers. A sound cut through the fog in her mind. Emma and Julian tore apart, staring. Both of them had been in the Hall of Accords in Idris when the Wild Hunt had come, howling around the walls, tearing at the ceiling. Emma remembered the sound of Gwyn's horn, blasting through the air, vibrating every nerve in her body, a high, hollow, lonesome sound. It came again now, echoing through the morning. The sun had risen while Emma had been wrapped up in Julian, and the road that led down to the highway was illuminated by sunlight. There were three figures coming up it, on horseback, one black horse, one white, and one gray. Emma recognized two of the riders immediately. Kieran, sitting his horse like a dancer, his hair nearly black in the sunlight, and next to him, Irloth, wrapped in dark robes. The third rider was familiar to Emma from 100 illustrations and books. He was a big, broad man, bearded, wearing dark armor that looked like the overlapping bark of a tree. He had tucked his horn under his arm. It was a massive object, etched all over with a pattern of deer. Gwyn the Hunter, the leader of the Wild Hunt, had come to the Institute, and he did not look pleased.
22. Those Who Were Older. Mark stood at an upstairs window and looked out at the sun rising over the desert. The mountains seemed cut out of dark paper, sharp and distinct against the sky. For a moment he imagined he could reach out and touch them, that he could fly from his window and reach the top of the highest peak. The moment passed, and once again he saw the distance between himself and the mountains. Ever since he had returned to the Institute, he had felt as if he were struggling to see everything through a thin layer of glamour. Sometimes he saw the Institute as it was, sometimes it faded from view and instead he saw a bare landscape and the fires of the Wild Hunt burning in small encampments. Sometimes he turned to say something to Kieran, only to discover that he wasn't there. Kieran had been there every morning that Mark had woken up for years of fairy time. Kieran had been meant to come and see him the night Mark had watched the children in the kitchen, but he'd never come. There had been no communication from him either, and Mark was worried now. He told himself that the fairy prince was probably just being cautious, but he found his hand straying to the arrowhead at his throat more often than usual.
It was a gesture that reminded him of Christina, the way she touched the medallion at her throat when she was nervous.